Are you on the RCR mailing list? Never miss a beat of the news and hard-hitting stories you've come to know and love. Stay in the loop. Visit realitycheck.radio/email.
Welcome back to the dialogue with Diwa de Boer on Reality Check Radio, where we discuss politics, power, and culture. You can text us your thoughts on 2057 or email your questions to inbox@realitycheck.radio. We are joined now by Professor Wall from On This Terrestrial Ball, who is an independent educator, podcaster, and self-determination advocate. He hosts the Secession Speakeasy and runs the Substack on secession movements around the world. Welcome to the show, Professor.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
And what got you interested in secession movements? Is there some more background on yourself that you could give us, some introduction for the listeners on why the interest in secessionism from around the world?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. I've always been a proponent, even as a young child, of my more local identity. I mean, growing up in the United States, I grew up in the state of Minnesota, and I was always Minnesotan first. I didn't talk to myself as an American, and that was just, and like I said, just something that came naturally to me as a child. And I grew up with the standard, basically American education, learning about, how great America was, about America's founding, and, how America had progressed to where it was through things such as the war between the states in the 1860s and so on. And so I would call myself, outside of that, advocacy that I had for my more local area, I was the pretty typical American kid. But when I went to college, I had a mentor who was a very fascinating professor who was really big into American history and taught us a lot about American history that I hadn't known just yet. And he was very good at unpacking the deeper roots of the beliefs of America's founding fathers, such as Thomas Jefferson, George Washington, James Madison, and so on. And he was also an advocate for secession. It was something that he had come to in his own development. And he talked to us a lot about secession and how secession was not a great evil as it is often portrayed because of its involvement in what happened in the unpleasantness of the 1860s in America. And he really began to open my eyes and really get me to focus on, it's like what really was going on here is like, one of the biggest things that he got me to start thinking about was the role of power and how power was something that was very dangerous. It had very dangerous roots and so on. And so I was kind of, trying to feel out, exactly what I believed and so on. And I stumbled on Congressman Ron Paul. Who I'm sure some of your viewers have heard of him. As I studied Ron Paul's beliefs and how he, what he believed and why he believed it and why it was always better to not rely on government, but rather more on the locals, I became a very fervent supporter of his. Needless to say, it was very disappointing to be so involved and to see how all these people were so excited, and yet he couldn't win the nomination for president of the United States in 2012 for the Republicans. And throughout that time, I began to see that there was a lot of shenanigans going on behind the scenes, that it seemed like as power was that in the areas where power was concentrated, that they had taken steps to deny the people what it seemed to be what the people really wanted. I mean, there were stories of shenanigans out of the Iowa and New Hampshire primaries in 2012 that, the boxes of ballots had gone missing and so on. And that was what really started me thinking, is like, well, how can we fix this problem? And then gradually, as I saw what Barack Obama began to do to accumulate more power to the United States government in his second term, I became even more alarmed. And I was like, this is not good. We've got to figure out how to fix this. And it began to dawn on me that the electoral system was proving inadequate as a solution to the problem. It seemed like We couldn't get enough good people in, and the few that we did, some of them stood firm, but some did not. And it seemed like the system was very self-protecting. And so that began to wake me up a lot to the dangers of power. And as I studied further, I came across statements such as the famous statement from Lord Acton, where he said, "All power corrupts, absolute power corrupts absolutely." I came across the quote from the author of The Lord of the Rings, J.R.R. Tolkien, where he talks about how, it's like the least, I'm trying to remember the exact quote here. He said, the least, no man is suited to boss other men around, and even saints are not suited for it. He said, and the people who are least suited for it are the people who are seeking out, are seeking those positions. And that really struck me because I began to see the truth in that based on all the experiences I'd seen with how the system protected itself and how it accumulated more power to itself and how it used that power to the detriment of the everyday people that I was surrounded by. And my studies kept growing from there. I came across, I learned about the Stanford Prison Experiment carried out by Dr. Philip Zimbardo, and he divulged it in his book, The Lucifer Effect, as to the observations he'd drawn from there, which was basically that power itself was the corrupting factor here, that as somebody gained more power and no check on it, no basic, there was no basic punishment for abuse of it, then the abuses would grow, basically more severe, and it could lead to tragedy, and it often did. And, so I saw that, and then I also read this book by a current philosopher named Michael Humer called The Problem of Political Authority, where he dives into the nature of power and authority by individuals. So basically, thanks to all of these different, experiences, reading Lord Acton, J.R.R. Tolkien, and then reading what Zimbardo and Humer had unpacked, it really led me to understand that unlike what the common saying is that money is the root of all evil, I came to understand that power was the root of all evil and that we needed effective checks on power. And I, tying that in with what I learned already, I began to see that, secession was the only real check on power that the common people possessed. That basically you had to put distance between yourself and the person who was engaging in the abuse. And this really came, I think it really set in on my mind as I saw the totalitarian tactics that came out during the COVID hysteria. And I think that was what inspired me most of all to start advocating for this and to just say, hey, people, we just need to, we got to put distance between ourselves and these people who want to run our lives. And I began to discuss things with secession activists at that time. I had conversations with Daniel Miller of the Texas Nationalist Movement, Alu Axelman, a well-known activist in the New Hampshire independence movement. I interviewed scholars like Frank Buckley, who wrote the book American Secession, exploring how bigness can lead to badness, and basically many other things like that. And it gradually grew into this the effort that I have now, which is basically we're doing these regular podcasts on secession movements across the world, because we noted myself and some other people who had a similar journey to mine to reach this point, we began realizing that there were actually a lot of news stories about secession across the world in late 2022, and that was how Secession Speakeasy, our main podcast, was born. And so we began to say, okay, we're going to cover this routinely now as part of this, and cover these movements and the news, and basically show people that secession is not a kooky idea, because that's the common term you hear from the more elite classes and so on. And out of that, we had a friend who assisted us with this with the podcast, who recommended we found a Substack, and that's how that was born. And we found that we had a lot of traction with both writing and podcasting. And I just want to say, like, in our goal in the end is to inspire people to learn a lot about self-determination and why that's so important, both in the personal realm and the political realm. And it's our hope one day to found our own institute where we're going to teach people about that and basically make it a more common thing for our everyday people.
Well, thank you for that very lengthy and detailed introduction. That answers a lot of questions right off the bat. I find a very good theme sort of to push in, you know, even if it's not in the context of secession, but at least localism, more local government, more devolved powers, subsidiarity is the more complicated, the older term I know that I've run into from the 1600s, 1700s, really talking about how ideally decisions should be made at the most local level possible. And that's where you prevent that concentration of power. And obviously, like you said, we've seen around the world now increasing concentration of power at a central level, which sort of seems to be, as societies are almost fragmenting, then the concentration of power at a central level grows. Do you see common themes in the secession movements that exist around the world? An easy question would be, like, why do these movements exist? And that may be different for every movement. So perhaps just common themes between whatever the continent, whatever the people, are there the same concerns across the world around secession?
Yeah, the main theme that I see throughout all these movements is that there's a general situation that has arisen where the common people, the situation for the common people is becoming untenable. And what that means is that they're not able to basically take care of themselves, provide for themselves, provide for their own needs, have their problems resolved, or at least resolved adequately. And as the untenability grows, they begin looking for solutions. I mean, the great Austrian scholar Ludwig von Mises says it very clearly in his magnum opus, Human Action, that acting man is eager to substitute a more satisfactory state of affairs for a less satisfactory. That's what drives a man to act. And that's basic. And this is something I push back against all the time. People say a lot of people who oppose secession, you know, and try and make arguments against it, have this assumption that secession activism just comes out of the blue. It's like, no, it's like there's reasons why people turn to this. And, you know, the untenability of the situation seems to be the number one thing that seems to drive popularity and organization for these movements. Another theme that I often see is that this is not a merely left versus right thing. It's the elite classes versus the common classes. The elite classes, more often than not, don't support secession. They like the status quo as things are. They like having that power. They like exercising that power. And when the common people finally realize that the elites don't have their interest at heart, they start turning and saying, okay, we don't want you here anymore. So we got to find ways to, you know, separate ourselves from you. And that's basically what secession is. It's separation, you know. It's just a more fancy word for separation. So they want to separate from these people. And if your regular avenues, such as elections, I know here in America, one of the things that drives it is that people are losing faith in our electoral system. I mean, we can see what happened in 2020, 2022, and even 2018. You know, I saw it back in 2012. You know, it's like where it was like, well, the elections aren't doing anything. They're not fixing things. So how do we fix this otherwise? And that's also another common theme. People turn to secession when they like we're out of other avenues to fix things. You know, and I would say the last thing is that governments as a rule oppose these no matter what, no matter who's behind them, no matter who is ideologically is running them and stuff like that. They don't want this thing to happen because they see it as a direct attack upon them personally. And it's like, and this is not unique to today. I mean, the British saw this with the Americans in the 1770s when the Americans declared independence. Okay, the Dutch saw this when the Belgians declared independence in 1830. Okay, it's like the obviously the American government saw this when the Confederates declared independence in 1861. I could go on and on and on. You know, even the Biafrans declaring independence from Nigeria in 1967. So it's a very common theme. I've never seen a government that just willingly goes in and says, "Yeah, we'll let you secede," because generally, the thing is that the governments are engaging in tyranny. They want to keep that control. And so as a result, they don't want to give it up. And so they will oppose secession as a rule. And that's generally the general term that I've, the general trend I've seen.
Is a common criticism that you get, a common criticism around secession, like you said, is sort of, is it separating yourself from other people, the country? You get into accusations, oh, well, that's nasty, you're being xenophobic, you're afraid of the other, and this is very much in contradiction to globalism, basically, right? So we need to all be together, we need to all be the same, but you get accused of being afraid, like you just need to be more welcoming, you just need to be more accepting of all of these different things, instead of saying, oh, these are these they're causing problems, or you know, the elites will point at you and say, no, you're the nasty one, you're the mean one, you just need to be more accepting.
Oh yeah, yeah, that's very, very common tactic. I mean, like, it's, a matter of fact, it's so common it's losing its effectiveness. Actually, that's something that we myself and my co-hosts have seen very frequently. They're now having to resort to new tactics in order to try to dissuade people from this, because this is losing effect, because people are seeing through the lies. And that's probably another thing that I see quite frequently with these secession movements, especially the ones that are grassroots organized, is that these people are, they're not, contrary to what the elites believe, the common people are not stupid. They have their own homegrown spun wisdom. Okay. They know what's going on. All right, they know what's going on, and they know how to fix things locally. And, you know, and again, it's like in the back, you know, back when things are not untenable, you know, they get a little, they, you know, if they're advocating secession, they get a little nervous about it. But when it's a situation where it's like, this is bad, you know, we need to fix it and all that and stuff like that, you know, it's like people see through the lies and they're like, no, it's like, no, I'm not. It's like, you're saying that about me doesn't mean anything, because that's, I know in my heart, that's not my motive. Okay. And the people around me know that that's not my motive. They know, because they see, they have the same problems that I do, you know, it's like, and they want a solution the same as I do, you know? And so, and that's why it's like, and that's something I take heart in that they're having to change the tactics that they're using to attack secessionists. A common one, I'll quick little tangent here. A new one that I saw come out of, they were attacking Staten Island in New York City for wanting to break away from New York City. And they knew that because of the situation, they knew that the, you know, the whole xenophobic labels and racist and whatever, you know, labels would not stick. And so what they did was they resorted to things like, well, you can't support a socialist government, so therefore you can't be your own city. And it was like, that was so ridiculous as to be laughable, quite frankly. It's like, who said anything about having to need a socialist government in order to form your own city? You know, it's just, yeah. So it's, so yes, those tactics have often been used, but thankfully they're losing their effectiveness, and they're losing it fast, because I'm sure, as you've seen worldwide, the situation for many people across the world is turning untenable right now.
And speaking of, people around the world, could you give us a quick run around the globe and an overview of perhaps some key movements in each region? Because as I've seen from your Substack and your commentary, that there are a growing number of secession movements in every single part of the world. So last week I spoke with some guests from Canada, and I haven't yet interviewed anyone from Quebec, which is a commonly known one that the French in Quebec wanted to secede from Canada. It's been going for a long time, but there are also other movements that I have heard whispers of in Canada, where people have been talking about the breakup of Canada, for instance.
Yeah, Quebec is a long-standing one. They've had largely cultural tensions with the rest of Canada because of that French culture you mentioned. Obviously, I'm sure some people might be aware, Quebec had two independence referendums already in 1980 and 1995, and the support grew from one to the other. I think it was a 60% no, 40% yes in 1980, and was a lot closer in 1995. It was just a couple percentage points, I think, away from a yes vote. But they have the same problem. It's like their culture is not respected. Their uniqueness is not respected from the federal, the nationalist, globalist level. Their unique needs, their unique culture, everything's not respected. And they have a couple, and there you kind of have, it's more of a sentiment than an actual just one particular movement. I mean, there's three political parties in Quebec that run on sovereignty issues. The most prominent one is Parti Québécois, which is the one that's leading it. You also have Quebec Solidaire and the Bloc Québécois. But the Parti Québécois is actually, they've had power before. I think they were in power when the 95 referendum was held, if I my memory serves me correctly. And their popularity is growing again because of the backlash from the COVID lockdowns and the Freedom Convoy crackdowns. And they've proposed a third referendum that they would like to hold after the next Quebec elections, which will be 2026 at the latest. Like I said, their unique culture is what's driving this, because Ottawa has had no respect for their unique culture. In regards to the rest of the country here, the Western provinces have had a long-standing grievances with Ottawa because they're resource rich in certain things that the whole country needs, and they often feel that their resources are taken and they aren't properly compensated. There's also the equalization payments and stuff like that. I don't understand the entire thing there, but that seems to be a common, very common dispute that they have. And as a result of that, you have separatist sentiment growing in provinces like Alberta, Saskatchewan, even parts of British Columbia, I understand. And, and the key lightning rod there is Danielle Smith, the premier in Alberta, because she is she's very defiant. She's very big into Alberta sovereignty. She's not secessionist, or at least as of yet. But she's taken a lot of defiant steps, and she's inspired the Saskatchewan premier to do the same. And again, like I said, because of her stances, the separatist sentiment is growing in Western Canada because of that. And then just a passing note here, I heard just the other day that there's a movement coming up in New Brunswick, which is also looking to split off, especially if Quebec goes independent in the not too distant future. So. Well, that's Canada. Obviously, America, is like, you have the ones that everybody seems to be at least aware of. I mean, mainly Texas and New Hampshire. You have those movements there, that are looking to pull those states out of the union. And then we have the state separation movements like Greater Idaho and Illinois separation. Illinois separation is they want to separate the they want to separate the rural counties from the city of Chicago and either join another state or form their own state, because Chicago, with its large population, kind of electorally ruins everything for the rest of the state and is leading to a lot of problems on that front. California is rife with secession movements. There's two movements trying to split up the state itself. There's the state of Jefferson in Northern California, there's El Dorado County and San Bernardino County, both wanting to secede, and they're actively trying to organize and approach that. I could go on and on and on. You got Louisiana just launched an independence movement the other day, about a month ago. State splitting movements are beginning to become popular as Greater Idaho gets and Illinois separation get more trend. You've got states like Washington, Minnesota, New Mexico, Colorado, Maryland, and Maine all either have separation movements or they're preparing for them. Even cities and counties are beginning to split. I mean, Baton Rouge, Louisiana just split into two cities just a couple of weeks ago.
I remember reading about that one. I was surprised that it actually happened, right? They just split the city and it passed. They voted for it. And I don't know what the consequences will be, but it's certainly possible. People are saying, well, this is very difficult, this is hard to do. People are pulling the levers on the mechanisms that they have and are actually doing these small acts of secession in places in the US. I've spoken with Daniel Miller from Texas, just for the listeners, if you want to go and find that older interview in RCR Replays. That's Daniel Miller from the Texas Nationalist Movement. And I've also spoken with Matt McCall from Greater Idaho, and both very interesting and very different secession movements in the United States. And if you've just tuned in, we're talking with Professor Wall from On the Terrestrial Ball about secessionism around the world. And he's just giving us a tour. I'll let you carry on now. Perhaps Britain is another good place and the rest of Europe and you know, a number of different attempts at secession there as well.
Oh, yeah. Britain is on... I actually wrote an article not too long ago. I said we may be staring at the end of Imperial Britain here pretty soon, because you have the Sinn Féin came to power in Northern Ireland, which is part of the United Kingdom. Sinn Féin wants to break Northern Ireland away and reunite with the Republic of Ireland. All they need is a Republic of Ireland government that's open to the idea before they begin the process. That may happen next year in the Irish elections. Obviously, you have the Welsh Nationalist Party did very well electorally in the recent British elections, and the sentiment is growing there. It looks like it's following a similar trajectory to what Scotland had a couple of years ago. The Scottish nationalist sentiment is still there. The parties are discredited, but it's still there. People still want another bite at that referendum apple. And I actually spoke to a Scottish independent scholar who said, we're just looking for a new leader and a new direction that's going to pull us out of this woke stuff that the old independence parties got mired in, you know.
Yeah, the Scottish one is interesting because the Scottish Nationalist Party was basically a globalist party masquerading as nationalists, where they said, oh, we want to break away from the United Kingdom so that we can become globalists, become part of the European Union and so on. Just bizarre. That's not and obviously that's why it failed. Yeah.
Well, and that was the thing. It was taken over by globalists because it didn't start out that way. When it was under Alex Salmond, it didn't start out that way, but it became that way. You know, it was corrupted eventually. So, yeah. But you're right. That is why it failed, because people were like, well, you're not serious about nationalism anymore. And then, you know, you mentioned the rest of Europe. I mean, like, you look at the Western powers, Spain and France, both of those countries are dealing with very serious separatism. Or secessionist sentiment. I've actually joked that I was like it's a coin flip as to which one's going to be the first to break up, because Spain's dealing with Catalonia. What's going on there? That activism is getting very heated, and you can see it in the rhetoric that's going on. And it's not just Catalonia. You have the Basque provinces, Navarre, Galicia. They all have secession movements that are very powerful and growing in popularity every day. In France, you've seen all the violence and the protests going on there. The French have a rebellious streak. The island of Corsica wants to break away. They've got part of Catalonia that wants to break away. There's whispers in the far western province of Brittany that there's a secession movement going on there and that they're growing in popularity. And, you know, and like I said, if France loses control, and the French elections, I think, demonstrated, you know, the futility of trying to reform the current French system. You know, it's like it's only a matter of time before France just falls apart at that point. And then Belgium, you've got serious problems with immigration and corruption going on there. And the Flemish, who make up part of that multicultural setup that Belgium is, the Flemish don't want any part of this anymore. They weren't able to win in the most recent elections, but they got a lot of seats. And the sentiment is that they're going to get another chance here real soon. And if that happens, then there's a question whether the EU even survives, because Brussels will then be surrounded by EU skeptic territory. And then in Bosnia, you've got the Republika Srpska. The Serbs in Bosnia are not being treated well. They're being put into very difficult situations by the globalists out of the EU and NATO. And they're trying to break away in the interest of self-preservation. I mean, Milorad Dodik's been making secessionist move talk for quite a while now.
So the Balkans are... A popular term for secessionism comes from the Balkans, right? Balkanization, sort of the complete breakdown of these central governments that led to war there. Just, you know, that's how bad things got in the Balkans in the 90s.
Yeah, it did. Although if you look deeper into some of the roots of that war, what it really was, it wasn't the acts of secession itself that caused the war. It was more trying to retain power that led to a lot of the conflict that happened there.
Yeah,
you know, it's like, as I mentioned earlier, you know, like governments don't like giving up power. You know, it's like, and that's what led to it. There was factions maneuvering for power, and that's what led to a lot of the conflict that ended up happening. So, in addition to being manipulated by outside powers like the EU and NATO, so, And I know you, I think you mentioned that you wanted to, do we have time to quickly touch on Africa and maybe one or two others?
Yeah, sure, sure. Give us a very quick rundown on Africa and perhaps other, was it in Asia or Oceania? Your top two or three on each one would be great.
Right, right. Yeah, no, it's like in Africa, what you have is the country of Nigeria. I mean, that country's on the verge of collapse. I mean, and there's already very strong secessionist sentiment coming out in the province and the provinces known as Biafra and Yoruba. So I keep telling people who follow secession, I keep telling them really closely, it's like, look, it's like, keep an eye on Nigeria. That may be one of the first dominoes to fall. South Africa, I'm sure a lot of people have heard about the racial tensions going on there. And there are secession movements there that are trying to basically protect themselves against that racial violence that's unfolding. It's usually that's the Cape of Good Hope wants independence, and then you've got communities like Orania that are trying to make themselves self-sufficient as part of forming their own country eventually. So you've got that, and then as you mentioned, over in Asia and Oceania, I mean, the Philippines is one that I'm also telling people to watch, because there you actually do have some political support for splitting the country up. I mean, former President Rodrigo Duterte has announced his support for Mindanao splitting up. So that would be one that I tell people, it's like, well, keep an eye on that, because they've actually got some political capital to play with. Bougainville Island, trying to split from Papua New Guinea. Apparently, they were promised independence, but there's been some reluctance there on that front. And then the other one that I would recommend people keep an eye on, because it could provide a blueprint for a peaceful separation, is actually Greenland. Greenland is looking to separate from Denmark, and they look to be trying to accomplish that peacefully. And they could provide a blueprint for the peaceful separation. So those would be basically ones that I would tell people, let's keep eyes on.
And we basically pointed at more polarized elections around the world, as that's really what's breathing more life into secession movements as well. You mentioned inconclusive elections in France, and just everything getting more heated. Is that something that you see as well as a common theme in terms of giving real life to secession movements?
That's definitely plays a role. It's like the polarization definitely plays a role. But I think the more important thing that's playing a role is just people, just common people, regardless of whether they're left or right, are just seeing elections as just, especially national elections, they're not getting what they want. And so they're basically just saying, and so the polarization is true insofar as it's like, well, we're not getting our agenda or these three forms that we need to fix these things. But then they're looking at the system itself. They're looking at it as a failure of the system. It's as the forecaster Martin Armstrong would call it, a loss of government legitimacy in the eyes of the people. And because these elections are inconclusive, as you said, or they're obviously rigged, they're just not working. You know, like the ones in the UK is like, you know, the Reform UK gets a higher percentage than the Liberal Democrats and only ends up with 5 seats, and the Liberal Democrats get 70. I mean, that's a sign of a dysfunctional system. Okay. So it's more that people are just realizing that the current systems are dysfunctional and that the leaders are not basically, you know, following what they need. And so it's like, so again, like I said, polarization plays a role, but it's the loss of legitimacy in the public eye that I think that's driving these secession movements more. And people are just saying, well, if you guys can't do it, then we're going to do it ourselves because we have problems that need to be solved here.
And one quick last question that you've already touched on, but it probably is worth repeating. Is there a clear left-wing versus right-wing distinction? Are there more left-wing secession movements or more right-wing secession movements? And are conservative and nationalist people more likely to be opposed to secession to try and keep their countries together, or would you say there's no real tilt in either way? It's not a left wing or a right wing thing, no matter where you look.
It depends on where and when. I mean, like the right wing definitely has a harder role, and there's definitely more of them, but the left wing has their share of problems too. You know, it's like, I mean, if you look at Spain, that's probably one of the most stark examples of it, because a lot of the secession movements in Spain are left wing, and they have a very hard road ahead of them to accomplish this. So, but again, the right wing has very hard road ahead too. I mean, Texas is going to face a very hard road. Greater Idaho, I'm sure you probably heard about some of the challenges they're facing. You know, it's like, it's so, but it goes down to what I said earlier. It's like, you know, governments, regardless of ideology, don't want to give up power. And that's what's going to be very difficult about just getting this across no matter what. So that's, and I think that's the most important thing to remember is that he's like, it's kind of like what they say in the Hunger Games. It's like, remember who the real enemy is. It's like your real enemy is the government in this case. Okay. So.
All right. Well, thank you very much for your time, Professor Wall. Any final word and some resources you'd recommend for listeners who are more interested in secession, localism, you know, devolving power and so on. I'm sure that they'd love to follow up on any recommendations you might have.
Yeah, well, you mean I would strongly recommend if people are interested in learning more. Like I said, we talk about secession weekly on our podcast, Secession Speakeasy. Type that in on our search engine, you should find it. I wouldn't use Google though, for obvious reasons. It's like, and you can do obviously you can go on Substack, look up our Substack, The State of Division. I try to write there and publish there frequently, and we do the podcast there as well. In terms of resources, I've got a couple of different books for people that I'm going to try and go through them as quick as I can. The first two that I usually recommend for people who are just getting into this and have common objections that they need to take care of, Breaking Away by Ryan McMakin from the Mises Institute. That's a very, very good book, very, very insightful. It's going to answer a ton of questions. I mean, McMakin put a lot of effort into that. Another book would be by Professor Francis Buckley. Named American Secession, and he's not like entirely pro-secession, but he makes a lot of good arguments on behalf of secession, mainly attacking the idea that governments that are too big do not represent people well, which is a very key secessionist argument and, you know, important for local. You can also look at books like Liberalism by Ludwig von Mises. He makes a very strong self-determination argument in that book. The State in the Third Millennium by Prince Hans Adam II of Liechtenstein also deals with self-determination, not entirely, but it's got some very good arguments. If you're more trying to convince left-wing friends to support secession, I'd recommend Break It Up, Secession, Division, and the Secret History of America's Imperfect Union by Richard Kreitner. It's a very good book and comes from a left-handed, left-wing perspective, and he does a good job. Matt Korvatov's book, I Want to Break Free, if you're looking to form your own movement, that's a good book to read, along with Diffusion of Innovations by Everett Rogers. In America, you can get a very good idea of the whole national divorce talk. Dr. Tom Woods's book, National Divorce, is also good. And if you're interested in the power dynamic and how secession is a key check against power, I strongly recommend you read two books I mentioned earlier in our interview. The Lucifer Effect by Dr. Philip Zimbardo and The Problem of Political Authority by Michael Humer. You're going to come up with a lot of good arguments again for checks against abuse of power, reading Zimbardo and Humer, both very well read. Not easy reads, but very good, and will give you a lot of arguments. And finally, I just want to throw out some online resources in addition to my own sites that I just mentioned. Red State Secession, which is a Substack. I know the person who runs that. They do really good work. They don't publish frequently, but when they do, it's really insightful. The Mises Institute has a lot of good self-determination resources. I strongly recommend you look them up, Mises.org. And the Abbeville Institute also comes up with some good resources at AbbevilleInstitute.org. So those are all resources that I would recommend people look up if they want to check this out. And again, by all means, check out our sites at Substack and Locals and on this terrestrial ball. If you want to go to the site where we link to everything, keepgovlocal.com. And I just want to leave your listeners with this this insight. I always tell people the solutions to today's problems always begin with us, the individuals, and the actions we take in our own lives and our own communities. And I think that's more important than ever in today's world, where we see the massive failure of the elites on the national and global stage. So I leave everybody with that, that, you know, if you want things to change, get involved, start forming your own movements to take power back.
Well, that is all we have time for today. And for the listeners, we will be back right after this break Thank you very much for your time, Professor Wall.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
Thanks for tuning in to RCR, Reality Check Radio. Do you like what you're listening to or dislike what you're listening to? Either way, we want to hear from you. Get in touch with us now. You can text us with your message to 2057. That's 2057. Or email us at inbox@realitycheck.radio. We'd love to hear from you, so connect with us today.